This is Cheryl McQuaid. I'm at the UAW Local 602 Hall. We're preparing to interview John Anthony. It's September 14th, 2005, and it's approximately 10:30 a.m. Also present in the room is
John Fedora,
Linda Johnson,
Kathy Berry,
Marilyn Coulter,
Mike Fleming.
John, could you tell us your name and spell it for us?
My name is Johnny L. Anthony, Sr., J-O-H-N-N-Y. Middle initial is Lee, and my last name spelled is Anthony, A-N-T-H-O-N-Y.
And what is your address?
My address is in 4738 North Michigan Road, Diamonddale, Michigan, 48821.
And your gender?
My gender is a male.
Are you married, and do you have children?
Yes, I'm married. I have 5 children.
National origin?
Black, African American.
And did you ever serve in the military?
No.
And how old are you?
I am 51 years old.
And what's your educational background?
I finished high school here in the Lansing, at Lansing Eastern High School. I attended University of Michigan, Mott College in Flint, Michigan, Lansing Community College. I have 3 degrees in mechanical drawing, a master blueprint reading, and I'm a skilled tradesman with the UAWGM, along with an ironworkers degree, 4 years.
Very impressive. What is your hiring date, and also what department did you hire into?
I hired in General Motors in 1972. Shortly after high school, I hired in on the assembly line at the main plant at General Motors at Oldsmobile. My job description there was installer. At the motor drop, we installed the dry shafts, and because I wouldn't stop talking, they kept putting more and more work on me. So I just didn't know not to talk, and so in 1972, when I first hired in General Motors, I worked for 3 years. Then I decided that I wanted to further my education, not knowing that I could be a part of, not knowing that I could go to school at General Motors. I decided to leave General Motors, and because at that time they were asking people to, if they wanted to be laid off. And I went to school, back to school, to further my education so I can become a skilled tradesman.
And when did you come back? At that time, did you hire back into Fisher Body, or?
No, I hired back in. I left General Motors Oldsmobile main plant in 1974, and then I hired back in General Motors 10 years later with a degree in, master degree in blueprint reading, reading schematics, and I had finished my ironworkers training at that time.
You said not knowing that you could go to school. Explain what you mean by that.
At the time, I would see people that were had those, what we call now, cushy jobs in skilled trades. But at the time, most of the people I worked around, they were, seems to me now, as I recall back, they were people that were from the South, and all they wanted to do was just work and just being happy to have a job. But I was noticing there were others that had the jobs of skilled trades, and no one really knew how they became skilled tradesmen, but I was eager to want to learn how to become skilled trades and have one of those jobs, not to work on the assembly line, but to be part of the process of keeping the assembly line running.
Was this a benefit that was afforded you by GM? Did you have to pay for your schooling?
No, I left General Motors and came back. I went to school on my own. I left Lansing and went to Detroit to school, and went to the Technical Trade Center in St. Agnes in Du Bois, and then I went to Wayne State at night.
So what is your hiring date into the Fisher Body plant?
In 1984, I hired in Fisher Body as a journeyman millwright. So 9-4 of 84, I hired back in with my... And they were hiring millwrights at that time, and I could have became an electrician too, but I decided to be in the millwright trade.
And what shift did you hire in?
I hired in on second shift.
Second shift?
Yes.
So what was it like coming back in under a different profession? And what did you think about being in two different facilities?
Well, oftentimes I would see some of the people that, you know, first of all, some of the people I worked with, they were saying that, you know, I was crazy for leaving that good job at General Motors, but I had other aspirations of becoming a tradesperson, and I wanted to further my knowledge in a field of being more productive in the arena of skilled trades. So coming back in, it was kind of like I had something to show those folks that were still working there on the assembly line that an opportunity was still there. Because I was not real happy working on the assembly line, because I was young. I was 18 years old, and I wanted to do something a little different with my life. A lot of people invested in me to make sure that I came to work at that time while I was at Oldsmobile, but I had other aspirations of trying to move forward.
So in 1984, when you came in skilled trades, which is considered a preferred means of employment here, were there many African-American males in the skilled trades arena?
No. As a matter of fact, when I hired in, the person that hired me, his name was Bishop Cato, Clement Cato, and he was from New York. And at the time, he was the acting superintendent in skilled trades, and he was one of the few black men in that position ever held that position here at Fisher Body. And when he hired me, and it really wasn't an interview, and I was so impressed with him that he said, "We need to have more blacks like yourself to come through. Do you know of any other African Americans that that have their journeyman's cards that need to be hired?" Because at the time, I think I was 29 years old when I hired back in, and I was the youngest skilled trades person at Fisher Body, and one of the only few ever that went through an apprenticeship program outside that got hired into the Fisher Body plant.
Did that make a difference to the other people, the fact that you were trained on the outside versus on the in?
Oh, there was some animosity, even from the supervision, because they were mostly hiring people that were farmers or farmers' kids and those that they were bringing up through their ranks. And most of the people that came through were older men. They were already, seemed to me like they were ready to retire. And they were actually bringing their children in, or their friends' children, into the skilled trades arena. Even at the time, the EIT program was very prominent and rolling, but if you didn't know somebody, you weren't going to get in.
For those who don't know, what's EIT?
The Employee in Training. The Employees in Training is, EIT means the employees that are in training, and those employees are employees from all sectors of life. They can come in from the outside of the General Motors sector, or they can be brought in from the inside with an aspiration of being able to want to work in skilled trades. Oftentimes, employees that would work during the changeover periods would be employees that would be good candidates, that would show that they have proficiency in those areas of the electrical trainings, millwright training, or working with the pipe fitters during the changeover periods, for like such as model changeovers and the Christmas breaks.
As we move forward to a new plant and we leave Fisher Body behind, the employee in training process, is that still, to your knowledge, will that still be implemented? Will that be available? Will their changeovers be the same as they used to be? Can you talk about that for us?
I think we're going to start seeing more activities where an opportunity would be made available to members that would like to have to further their knowledge in the skilled trades arena. The employees in training per se may be used as a tool such as the apprenticeship program, and making that more available to the members on how to actually start off a process of being involved into the skilled trades arena. So what we're looking at now, because we have such an older workforce and there's more people that would like to broaden their knowledge in skilled trades, we're looking at having the buddy-buddy system, or you could use the same term as an employee in training, working with the older people to pass that knowledge that has been awarded to those members through the years to the younger people, so that we can continue to be world-class in what we do.
John, going back to when you came in off the street, mm-hmm. and you went into the skilled trades arena. What was it like for you on an average day? And the second part of that question is, what is it about skilled trades that makes them special and makes them so tight?
The one thing that that my fondest memory of coming into an area, you have to, when you understand that my main responsibility was to build a building and to put up all the equipment, but not to actually make the equipment run. So now my whole focus had to change from actually building the building, finishing the product, and going to the next job location or the next city or the next state. Now my focus was to be there amongst my people, that the people that were actually going to build a product. So my knowledge was, like many people in skilled trades, everybody brings a certain type of knowledge to a facility. And so there was no big U's and a little I's. We all brought something very special. Whereas I knew how to read schematics and blueprints, the next guy could probably weld. And the next guy knew chains and conveyors. So we all would combine our thoughts together and work as a combined crew to work towards one common goal, that is to keep the assembly line running and making sure that the workers, their needs were met as best we could. And so that was a change in thought patterns, and that's why the employees assistance programs, the EPG groups, whereas we can all combine our groups and efforts together, working in conjunction with the members on the floor, it tied in the whole process on how to make the process work within a structured area to be able to build a product. And building a product meant, first of all, building a people. And once you build quality people, you can build a quality product.
Now, you said EPG.
Employee Group Participation, and that included skilled trades, the hourly workers, the supervisors, the superintendents in the area. And we would just combine our efforts as far as what could we do within that group to better serve a build process for the entire car process.
Now, skilled trades are different from production workers, and they seem to be a tight-knit group. Is it safety issues, or is it because you guys ate lunch together? What drew you guys so close together?
I think, you know, from the beginning of my experience of being a skilled trades person, I relied so much on that one individual. If we were doing a job together, I needed to know what his thoughts were. I needed to know what his next action was going to be, because his life depended on my life and my life depended on his life if we were working on anything. So in essence, it was a different, that was part of the difference, but you actually knew what type of the next move was. When you deal with a skilled trades person, you want to build a relationship so close that you want to know the next move, because the next move could be fatal.
Have those next moves and getting close to that person went outside the plan? Have you had friendships that went beyond these walls?
Oftentimes you will build a relationship in the plant, but also outside of the plant, you'll find members that would like to do projects such as build pole barn buildings or build houses, and you can actually take your talent outside of the plant location to help assist or to and save money. You save an awful lot of money by knowing that you have an electrician friend, or you have a pipe fitter friend, or me being a structural person and an operator, a crane operator, they all would call on each other, or we would all call on each other to assist each other and become our own contractors. So it's a big money saving adventure when you can team up with a group of people that's on one mind and one accord. So that in essence brought about a closeness with working together with skilled trades people. And do you get it from all people? No, because some people just want to come to work and do their little thing in this one little small area. But when you get someone that's energetic and versatile in different activities and don't mind taking their talents outside the workplace, it makes such a difference.
What department of skilled trades did you work in? Facilities, body, paint?
When I first hired in, I worked in the facilities group. And at that time, we had everybody worked in the facilities group, and we were almost like firemen. Wherever there was a breakdown, we'd all jump on our little trucks, and we would go cruising to that location, and everybody would take the welders and the cutting torches and everything out, and we'd put the fires out, if you would use it as a fireman. But the majority of the time, we would go there and find out what the problem was. We would be dispatched from the facilities group, but then we changed our way of doing business. We actually started making different satellite cribs in the paint department, the trim department, and in the body shop, but we also kept the facilities group. Those that were in those different groups were able to become the masters of those different groups. They knew those different groups. So then at that point in time, we had three different shifts running, first shift, second shift, and third shift, and we tried to coordinate our efforts to make sure that the shifts overlapped so that we could tell each other what went on in those areas and where the problems were, and any downtime we could actually, if we couldn't fix the problem to keep the line running immediately, we'd make sure that the third shift would tear it back apart and fix it to make it last.
Do you know about when that was?
That was in 1980, between 1986 and 1987.
Was that part of a changeover?
Oftentimes, we could do a major change on the weekends, and it depended on the problem. We worked every weekend. I remember working for years, 7 days. You know, we worked 7 days a week, you know, on fixing items and making sure that things that needed to be attended to were done and done well.
John, you said that your lives depended on it, and it was safety that kind of brought you together. Can you tell us what is meant by that? I mean, how safe do you have to be? What is it?
Well, oftentimes when you're working on a piece of equipment or you're preparing yourself to work on equipment and you are working in a group with a group of different trades or similar trades to yourself, you have to really know the person that you're working with. Oftentimes, it takes a combined effort to be able to put together a plan. First of all, you have to have a plan, and you have to have a safe plan to be able to put a project to completion. You have to check the equipment over, making sure the equipment is safe, the cables, the surrounding area that you're working around, and the overhead area that you're working around. And most of all, you have to make sure that your coworkers are cohesive enough to realize the task that's before us. Oftentimes, I've been in situations where, if it's after lunch, that some of the players would have to be we have to change some of the ways that we would do things, because if some of the players are inebriated, and oftentimes there were some of our team members that would, you know, do a little bit too much drinking on the job. Not on the job, but, you know, at lunch. That would change the way we would have to proceed at doing our project of the day. I've had a lot of close incidents on where we've really depended on a coworker, and they just could not handle the task at hand. So I'm reminded of a few of the incidents that has happened to me personally, where we had a broken chain in the trim department, and I relied closely on one of my coworkers to put air back onto the cylinders to tighten up the chain. But you have to put your hand into the drive unit to make that happen, and it is so important to know each other and to know each other's actions, because if my coworker would have put the air on too fast, it could have snapped and my hands could have been cut off immediately. But, you know, knowing that it's important to have someone that's thinking like you, that knows what to do, and that has been well trained in those same areas.
Have you ever lost a coworker?
Yes, I've lost two coworkers here at the Fisher Body plant. One in the past when I hired in, it didn't seem like the safety issues were as well thought out, or we didn't have the proper equipment to work with, or oftentimes because we all came from different background areas, many times we would make our own tools because we had the capability of making hooks or using different types of chain that had not been inspected according to the OSHA or my OSHA standards. And we would make different types of hooks to make our job more easily accessible or to fit the need to keep the lines running. I'm reminded of one of our members out in Building 23 that made it what he called a safety hook, but under pressure, that safety hook did not hold, and it came, once it was under much tension, it came back and snapped back, broke, came back and killed him. And we're often reminded of that time in Building 23. You never forget when someone dies because of trying to do the right thing and trying to be a good tradesperson, but though equipment must be purchased by a supplier and it needs to be tested to make sure that it meets OSHA and my OSHA standards.
Are there any other incidents that you know of within the plant that we've had fatalities, like contractors or anyone that came from the outside that had the same types of?
We've had several other incidents, such as the one that happened in the paint department, and where we had the supervisor went down into this tank to, he gave an order to the employees to go down there and clean out the tanks. And a lot of times when you're dealing with toxic waste, it's okay until you go and stir it around. And then the fumes overtook the employees. And then the supervisor went down there to get the employees, and he also was overtaken. And that brought about some training that we had to have as far as how to deal with toxic waste. And believe me, whenever a situation like that happened, you are always reminded of the possibility of losing your life. So every day you come to work, even though we don't know what our tasks are every day as far as skilled trades, we don't know what job or job responsibility we will have. But whatever the job is, we must first treat it as though it may be our last day.
That would be considered under our confined space.
That's correct.
Training that we've been going through.
Yeah.
We also had an incident in, I think, trim area.
Yeah, we've had contractors come in, and being a contractor myself, as I mentioned earlier, you don't understand the surroundings or the atmosphere of a factory, or you're not familiarized, such as a tradesperson that lives in that factory daily, knowing the different e-stops or the safety aspects of the direction of the chain on how it's actually installed. You coming in to actually work on one piece, and you don't have the same knowledge of the people that live there every day. You're familiarize, or you're relying on someone else to make decisions that could cause your life. As a tradesperson from the outside, you're a specialist in an area, but you're not familiar with all the surroundings or the things that are going to happen if one part of a system is released. And I'm reminded of that incident that happened up in the trim department, where we had a contractor that someone gave an okay for the chains to start up on the door's return line, and we had a fatality there that day also. And my understanding is that employee, outside contractor, that was his last few days of before he retired. But it's a sad call when you have to call home to someone and tell them that their loved one is not coming home anymore.
And that's one of the reasons why we have a Workers' Memorial Day. when the health and safety standards that we'd been through. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I've had all those trainings, and I've been involved with the Workers Memorial, and many people take it very lightly and not realizing the importance of it, but it is very touchy that when that day does come, and when we wear the white shirt day, that's very touchy, and knowing that there's been bloodshed for our UAW members, and thanks, you know, it is nice to have that day recognized.
Thank you for sharing that particular memory, knowing that that's difficult to talk about loss, but it's also great for education of that. But in changing gears a little bit, I know that you said it was difficult when you came in. Have you ever worked with women skilled trades people, and how do you feel about them, and what types of things did you notice some of the women had to go through?
Well, a lot of the things that I've dealt with working with women or the females that were our trades persons, you know, it seems like a lot of the women feel that they have to fit into a man's world, and that's not so. You know, women are as important, and they're as knowledgeable as any man, and everybody brings something very special to the table when it comes to the trades aspect. And I often have felt that discrimination to anyone is discrimination to all of us. I've been privileged to work with women in the electrical, the millwright, the pipe fitters trades, the tool repair, and tool makers. We have had a great relationship. We just have worked together and brought different ideas to the table, and making sure that everybody is treated equal.
And now that's for you. Do you find that that's for most? Is it just at that point you're just a tradesperson, and it doesn't matter if you're male or female?
Oftentimes, some of the EEO standards had to be changed because, being that in the past here at Fisher Body, we've had men that were thinking that, well, this is my workplace, and I can bring my pictorials, and I can say whatever I want to say, and I can pretty much, she's just one of the boys. And, you know, realizing and understanding that the EEO standards brought about changes, and the civil rights acknowledgement of the fair treatment and fair rights to all people made men come to grips and realize that women must be treated equal, but you have to leave all that foolishness at home. A lot of the pictorials and all that men would bring and put in their lockers, and Playboy pictures and all that stuff, that's the workplace is not the place for it.
And that changes another vein. You're a skilled tradesperson, but you're also union active, yes?
Yes.
And what prompted that, and what do you do as a member of the UAW?
As a member of the UAW, I'm a international appointed benefits representative. I've been a benefits rep now for 14 years, being active in also the Civil Rights Department, with Civil Rights Department for the local union, and I've done that for, I think I'm probably the longest standing member now of the Civil Rights Department for the local union of Local 602. I've been a member of the several other different activities within the local union, including but not limited to also a member of the election committee, skilled trades advisors committee, liaison between management union for the skilled trades group, employee group participation member also.
So you've been active with the union for a long time. Are you the only member of your family here? And are you the only one active in the union?
No, my wife is a member also of the UAW Local 602, and a member of a member of Local 602, and she works also at Fisher Body. I have several cousins that are members here. Several of my family members are members of Local 602.
So now, did you meet your wife here?
Yes, I met my wife here in 1990. We were married in 1992. We have one son. Yes. She works in the paint department.
How did you meet your wife?
At lunch, up in our famous cafeteria. We're just sitting there talking, and I think at the time they were going through the transitioning of being able to, having to sit in the cafeteria because production was slow. So, and I had some free time to be able to go up and talk to her and just try to find out what her plans were in life and if there was any hope for us. And but I mainly married her for better and for work.
Could you share with us, Jen, maybe one of your favorite bosses, one of your favorite memories, a favorite memory of Fisher Body?
Well, one of my favorite memories of Fisher Body probably was the day I got hired, because that day I was actually, you know, when you're getting prepared to go on vacation, and we had scraped up enough money prior to working at Fisher Body, I would do just about any type of odd job. And so in the past, I know this, that every time you try to get ready to pack and get ready to go on vacation, the phone keeps ringing and ringing. So I took the phone off the hook. Probably 2 to 3 weeks prior that, I had applied for work with General Motors here at Fisher Body, and I had put down a friend of mine's name, Willie Loggins, and as a reference of a second contact person. And you know, at that time we were home packing up and trying to get ready to get all our little things together to leave and go to St. Louis, Missouri. And my friend came over. He said, "John, Fisher Body has called the house several times for you. Is your phone off the hook or something?" I'm going, "But yeah, I'm leaving work. I'm leaving town." He said, "Man, they keep calling. They want you. They want you to come by." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll go by there." So I pulls up at the front of the building, and my family was all in the car, and we were all packed and ready to go. And I called over first and told them. I said, "Yeah, I'll come over, and I'll just tell them that we just want you to come over and let us know you want the job." I said, I'm not going to stay because I got to go on vacation. I need time off. So I came in and I talked to Mr. Bishop Cato. He was the superintendent at the time through the maintenance department. He said, "Well, you have the job. Do you have time to go do an interview?" I said, "Well, really, I don't really have time to." I said, "But I will." So I went up to our medical department and did an interview and did the physical and passed the physical. And mind you, the family's still out there. Now it's an hour later. And so I was really pleased and thankful, but you know, knowing that, you know, prayer changes things, because you know, when you don't have a good job, you can't do a lot of things. And I'm forever in debt to know that there were some older women. Every noonday I would go to church every noonday and pray, and I was just praying that, that I would get a good job so I can make sure I can take care of my family, because I knew that the Lord had blessed my other cousins and with a good job. And I said, "Lord, if you can just bless me. I have been obedient. I have went back to school. I have degrees, and I have something to offer a good company." Because I knew that every time I go to the employment office and put down my knowledge and what I knew how to do, they would say, "Well, nobody's going to hire you. You're overeducated." I'm like, "Well, what do I need to do?" She said, "You need to start lying and telling them that you'll work for $9 an hour." I said, "Well, I'll do that." And so what I did, I would get two jobs so I could make sure, because, you know, today's money is, today's market, it doesn't seem like it's fair when you have a good education to be able to utilize it to get what you want. So I was just thankful that I was able to get in the Fisher Body to take care of my family. And as I said earlier, I worked 7 days for 5-10 years. It didn't matter, because I was able to come out of debt. I was able to see those older people there, and many of those skilled trades guys, they have lots of money, and they would show it sometime. And I was like, "Man, I need to get some of that long money like that." And within 2 or 3 months, I would have two or three checks that I wouldn't even have to use, because when you're making $3,000 and $4,000 a week, money is good, and you can have a lot more. So we were able to do that. But when I left that place that day, I still went on vacation, because I told them I'd come back. It was the weekend of Labor Day coming up. And when I left, I pulled down towards Section, and I looked at that big green building. And that big green building, I've been here ever since. And I went down the highway, and I would cry. I would just say, boy. And I made it in. And at the time, I think I was making $12 an hour. That was a lot of money in 1984. And I would just get a thought of, man, when I get back, I got a real job. I have a real job. I can make some real money. And they say, you're going to work. And oftentimes, the guys would tell me, say, you're going to make a lot of money, and don't be afraid of spending it. Just go ahead and spend it, because there's more coming. And you'll have more before you can spend it all. And I just started saving in that 401k, in that PSP. And, you know, and I don't know if without that and without being able to work at a place like this, would you ever be able to save over $250,000? No. And, you know, so, you know, being able to put money away and be able to save money for your children's education and be able to do the things that you want to do for your family, it's just unbelievable. So, you know, to General Motors, to the UAW, to the complete staff, both places, you know, I'm forever in debt and forever grateful. That's why I work hard today to continue to serve. And thank God for the UAW.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Thank you.